As you probably heard in the news segment, Congress is likely to vote today and likely to vote yes on a stimulus package to keep people afloat financially while much of the economy is shut down because of the coronavirus outbreak. At roughly $2 trillion, the congressional bill is a record-setting package, but in the near term, it will not put people back to work, and unemployment claims have been skyrocketing. Our first guest today works at a university business school. Michael Hicks and two colleagues published a paper not quite 2 weeks ago predicting job losses in the range of 1 in 6 workers. Let's get into the details. Michael Hicks is the director of the Center for Business and Economic Research and a professor at Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So what did you set out to do here?
Well, 2 weeks ago sure seems like the distant past.
Doesn't
but,
it?
what we were trying to do was to assess how many American workers fit what are working in close proximity to someone else. So there's actually a Bureau of Labor Statistics data on work context, and these include how often you interact with another human being and then how physically proximal you are. I mean, that's important because you might be not physically proximal. You might be on the phone with someone and working with them, or you might not be interacting with them like on an assembly line, but you might be 6 or 8 feet away from them, which is reasonably close. So we looked at those. We sorted employees by those categories and then came up with a very large number, about 40% of American workers. We took out of the mix healthcare workers. None of those seem to be at risk of losing jobs right now,
no.
At least not big numbers. And then we added back people who may not be physically proximal but are in an industry that's going to essentially close down. So, a dishwasher may not be interacting with the public or interacting closely with other people, but there's no restaurants working, at least certainly not the way they did a week ago. So that gave us a number of about 1 in 6, about 28 million American workers that are going to be just clobbered, we think, from this social distancing.
Which makes for that's a huge number.
Right, yeah, 1 in 6. And I think it's being reflected over the last couple of weeks in the unemployment numbers. At least the weekly jobs claims have gone near record numbers just in the last week, which was the first week of this week. I think Thursday, when the data are released by the federal government for last week, we'll see record numbers. And I'm afraid the week after that, we'll see record numbers of new jobless claims. We're hoping that it tops out, in this first end of the first quarter, which is we'll know next Friday, a week from Friday, with the job numbers at an unemployment rate about 10%. And then I think if we do this for another month, which I think we should, we're going to end up with an unemployment rate nationally of about 15%. And, of course, that really depends on how businesses react, how much people do take out and carry out and at restaurants and this that sort of thing.
All right, yeah, a whole bunch of assumptions you have to make here, though, because as you acknowledge in the research here, that there's no recent event with which to compare. So you had to grab the raw figures, it sounds like, and make some assumptions about businesses that would and would not be affected.
Right. I mean, we have data on what people are doing, but we don't know, for example, how many. We know, for example, the 2.5 million waiters and waitresses are probably in real trouble from this. But, short order cooks, restaurant cooks, maybe they're all still working. I'm not allowed to leave the home to find out. So I think the challenge is matching this downturn with something in the past. And the closest I can come up with in terms of historical precedent is that early 1942 rationing, which clobbered, restaurants, people who did any sort of specialty food service, your baker and butchers, gas stations, laundromats, vast share of American commerce was shut down during World War II to divert resources to the war effort.
Right, very early in the war effort, obviously, as we just joined in late 1941. How big do the do you have at your fingertips how big the unemployment rate got at that time?
Oh no, it plummeted though, and here's the what I try to explain to people is the data are going to be really shocking.
Mm-hmm.
Next Friday, we're going to get an unemployment number that's probably the worst single month in American history, and would actually beat the worst previous month was September 1945, which is right after VJ Day. So it's, and nobody would trade off that high unemployment for going back to fighting the war. So it's important not to get too freaked out over the economic data. And the goal of this study was to try to give a sense of the magnitude of the government intervention that I think it would be necessary, not to freak people out, because if you look back at World War II, those austerity measures were designed to divert resources to the war effort. But for the people in those sectors, it was a very real recession. If you were a butcher, you were out of business. If you were a baker, you were probably out of business. If you ran a auto dealership, you were out of business. You had no cars coming in. And so at the same time, though, the government, not intending to stimulate the economy, drafted 9 million out of a military that grew to almost 14 million at its peak. So unemployment shrank down to 1.5% by 1944, much below what it was 6 months ago. And we engaged in the consumption of a lot of wartime material, things that didn't have a practical peacetime use: German tanks, battleships, B-17s. And so the historical precedent doesn't argue that we're in a bad economic spot for the long run. Because the things that we saw rebound after the end of rationing showed a very strong recovery. It was just a disruptive period in American life, which is what I think we're going through now, but not one that is sort of full of shadows and deep economic disruption for the long run.
Michael Hicks is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's a professor at Ball State University in Indianapolis at the Miller College of Business and the director of the Center for Business and Economic Research within that college. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we talk about the clobbering of the economy and what the ripple effects might be. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. As you mentioned, 2 weeks feels like a very long time ago now. Are some of the assumptions you made 12 days ago already somewhat dated?
Yeah, some of them are. And I live in a state, and I think you do as well, that is now essentially under lockdown.
Yep.
So it doesn't really matter what occupation, you're locked down for some period of time. We still have class. My research center is still open. We're just working from 18 remote spots. Sort of magnitude of this in the short run is very high. My suspicion is most of those jobs will come back at some fairly reasonable point when we have some more protection, we know more about the virus, it may be easier to send people to factories where they're physically very separate. A lot of American manufacturing right now already wears clean clothing, wears a sort of a protective suit anyway. So extending that to risk of COVID would be fairly easy. The logistics and supply chains are holding fast. So I think what we're really talking about over the summer, after a brief, month or 5 or 6 week period, is going to be what sort of protective restrictions are in place after that, and how does that hit these same folks who are being clobbered now: gaming managers and food preps, chefs. Mm-hmm. Waiters and waitresses and airline pilots. Are we going to go back to that very soon? But other than that, the landscape of the summer looks much the same.
That's an interesting point to bring up, though, that there might be some additional precautions even after the period of intense lockdown. We're still going to be looking at each other in ways we didn't used to before, and considering ways in which we come in contact with each other and common surfaces and stuff like that as well.
Right. And we don't know, I don't know at least, what that will look like. My guess is it's going to be, at least until the vaccine is adapted or some treatment is available that reduces the mortality and morbidity of this, we're going to be at some sort of social distancing, which will put these 1 in 6 workers at huge risk. The factory workers, the truck drivers, the teachers, the college professors, the insurance sales, all those folks can still work at home. And sustain our social distancing. But for these folks, their job really depends on being around other people and interacting with customers.
You already mentioned the food industry, you know, food and bar operations where, the waiters and waitresses are pretty much out of luck. But, you know, you could still have cooks working and a lot of takeout only still going on within the food business. Examples you give, like a travel agent could work away from people, sure, but not a lot of demand for the service at the moment. I wonder, transportation retail as well, you point out, no place to go but down essentially at the moment. But grocery stores, this is really interesting. I'm seeing hiring from several chains. You know, one of our chain grocery stores actually delivered our groceries last night. That's never been done before.
Right. And I think we are at some risk of discounting the entrepreneurial capacity of Americans faced with this. We're seeing the same thing that, you know, I'm in a college town. We closed the dorms. People are gone. The labor force is gone. So the restaurants that want to remain open are hiring. So it's not just the McDonald's and the Burger Kings that are doing drive-thrus. So the sit-down restaurants, you can get online, call in, order a big meal. They'll package it up, put it in a big bag. You can bring it home. You know, there's doctor recommendations how to repackage it so that you avoid any contamination if somebody inside has COVID-19. And then those sort of responses in grocery stores, they open them up at different times for different people. So 6 to 8 a.m. is, and then in the morning and the evening are for older people who may be at more risk. So they're encouraging everybody else to stay away. The restocking of food is being done differently. So it may be that there are employment options out there, but it's very difficult for me to envision them without defeating this disease, getting back to the 3.5% unemployment rate that we walked into this crisis with.
And here again, what you came up with, you, Dagny Falk, and Srikant Devaraj in the paper, Occupational Exposure to Social Distancing, a preliminary analysis using ONET data. You talked about what that data is. 28 million plus jobs lost. You figure about 1 in 6 workers. Now, we recently had, I think it was just yesterday, James Bullard at the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis estimating unemployment getting as high as 30%. As the situation goes on, I know you've been putting out additional papers. Have you gone back and recalibrated some of the assumptions you made in this paper?
Well, I haven't yet. We've done some further modeling where we actually looked at the unemployment rate that would likely occur from this sort of distancing plus some other things, the closures of gaming facilities and the like. And I'm getting a unemployment rate of about 15%. Mm-hmm. And I know Jim Bullard, I think he's right. But part of the unemployment rate is going to come from the shutdown. So, for example, here in Indiana, more than, I'm going to guess, 60% of jobs are currently shut down. Most of the shutdowns in the manufacturing sector, for example, those are going to be like 2 weeks. And then they'll probably bring people back. And they're paying workers through that. So there are a number of businesses that can continue to do this. I'm not sure that's going to be a major economic impact. And if you just look at the experience of a short shutdown, like a major storm, a hurricane that doesn't do a lot of damage to business infrastructure, we recover from those things quite briskly. I mean, it really takes a Hurricane Sandy or Hurricane Katrina or Hurricane Rita to upset a local economy, but even within days of that, we recover briskly. So a lot of the immediate closures could be over with in a few weeks if we discover some sort of, you know, protective garment. We have enough face masks and gloves for people at factories to wear. But, you know, without an end to the disease, I just don't see people clustering back in bars. It's hard to slurp down a cold IPA with a face mask on. And I haven't tried it yet. I'd love to.
But you're willing to, yeah.
I'm willing to do my part. But I think the point is that I still think we're stuck with about 1 in 6, maybe 1 in 5 workers who are really at risk under any sort of social distancing until the disease is defeated. And much of the rest of the economy could come back fairly quickly. I'm not encouraging that. The benefit-cost analysis on staying locked down for a month or more is very easy. The lockdown's well worth it.
Michael Hicks, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana. We're talking about effects of the lockdown and keeping people out of jobs. Now, you do make reference in the paper to some possible offsets in productivity of people working from home. I mean, could they surprise people who've been tracking the numbers?
Right. It's interesting. There are a number of examples of academic studies that have looked at places where people were, large corporations were sent home, people sent home, and then measured productivity very profoundly, very carefully because of the work they were doing, like in coding. And we actually, it went up. There was a short lag as people made adjustments in their office and that sort of thing. But it turned out that it actually went up. And I think if we're thinking about long-term effects here, we might find that, you know, every restaurant in the future has got a good plan for carry out or an improved plan for carry out. We may find that there are a number of businesses that say, gosh, you know, if you guys want to go work at home, maybe I'll just shrink my footprint in commercial office space, have some places where we can meet, and let's just work from home. It saves money, it saves me cost, and you're just as productive. So I think we're going to learn a lot of things like that. And in my profession as a professor, you know, I'm an economist. I teach a class online, you know, anyway, in an MBA program. There are a lot of classes that are great online. I got a friend who teaches piano. It's going to be really tough to get the quality of that online to a class. And so I think those sorts of things are going to shake out over the next few weeks and surprise many of us.
Well, I mentioned being surprised by the grocery delivery, and Liz in Talent emailed in, wants to know which store is delivering groceries. It was Fred Meyer in South Medford, Liz. Thanks for the question on that. And I suspect other stores. I know Fred Meyer in North Medford is doing it as well. There are no recommendations here, Michael, but the paper concludes that the situation warrants immediate public policy concerns for federal and state policymakers. What do you make of us having this conversation 12 days after the paper's release and Congress might vote on a final bill today?
Profoundly disappointing, not only in the speed with which Congress has addressed the problem, but in the composition of the plan. And so let me be clear. I think there are a broad number of economists who weighed in on this and Twitter, online, and op-ed pages, including myself. There are really three things you got to do. The first one is you got to take care of these workers in this paper. I mean, many of them are not going to be eligible for traditional UI support. They're going to be more likely to try to do things, you know, under the table that would spread the disease. These are really the folks we need support. I'm always happy to take support. I got two college kids back home. But the fact is that these are the folks who really need help. That was step one. Step two is to make sure that the businesses that employ these people are around in 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 9 weeks, if we were to be able to reopen the economy. If they're gone, if that employment connection's gone, it's going to be a much more delayed recovery. And then the third step is to do something to help the people who are really on the front lines of this, which are state and local governments. Tax revenues for Oregon, Indiana, California, Michigan are going to get clobbered by this, and local governments are going to get clobbered, and the federal government has the capacity to backfill that. And this bill, in my judgment, does none of those three at a minimally effective level. And I think that's something for the weeks and months ahead to review closely, and something to talk about in November when we're thinking about who ought to be representing us in times of crisis.
Indeed. Much more of the picture still to come into focus. Michael Hicks is the director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at Ball State University in Indiana. Thanks for the analysis, and thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Good to be with you. Stay well.
You bet.